Well, hello and welcome to Radio. And thank you once again for being part of the show, for tuning in, and thanks for the numbers going up on listens to the podcast, and thanks for the folks that are listening on the actual, you know, radio, for those of you that still do that sort of thing. I'm very glad that folks are tuning in, and I'm glad that people are getting something out of it and saying nice things to me. It means a lot. I like telling these stories. And speaking of stories, here's one that I am not sure why it has taken me so long to tell. It's been nearly 50 years, and there are only a few people who actually know this story. I guess it's kind of a confession. The truth is, I have lived the last 50-ish years of my life on borrowed time. It could be really that I'm on somebody else's time, someone whose name I don't even know, because I shouldn't be here. I should be dead. And if not for someone else's incredibly bad fortune, I would be. Anyone who has ever traveled Maryland's Route 50 down to Ocean City may recall that just a few miles outside of town, there's a spot where a railroad freight line crosses the highway. Happens in a lot of small towns. It's a lonely spot outside of any of the small towns on the way to the beach, and there's just no lights there. It's very dark. Not well lit at all. And back in the 70s, this little railroad track highway kind of combination was ungated. Maryland was kind of infamous for its ungated railroad crossings at the time, and it may still be, I don't know. The tracks just crossed directly across the highway right here in this dark place, and I can't remember if there was even a signal light. I'd been down to the beach with my girlfriend. It was a hot August Sunday. We were in her car. I was driving, although I should not have been behind the wheel of even a boardwalk bumper car, much less her Torino at the time. I was not drunk, but I probably had had an illegal beer or two. We were both too young to be drinking in Maryland at the time, and I was dead tired. I had played until 2 that Sunday morning with my band back up in Baltimore before she and I decided to jump in her car and make the 3-hour trip down to the ocean. We were, as we say in Maryland, Danny Ocean Hun. And for all of that long, hot Sunday, we swam, napped on the beach, ate French fries and pizza, and stayed to watch the moon rise over the Atlantic. It was indeed pretty much a perfect beach day. It was probably around, 10 p.m. before we headed back to the Western Shore. I was fighting to stay awake before we'd been on the road for even 10 minutes. Now, Jeannie, my girlfriend, she said she could drive, but being the dumbass, macho teenage boy that I was not going to have my girlfriend be driving me around. I mean, come on, man. That is just not cool. So I cranked down the windows and cranked up the 8-track player, and we headed up 50 toward Baltimore. I'm not sure how far we were out of town when an old primer splashed beater came blasting up behind me in the fast lane, headlights flashing and horn blaring. There was no other traffic anywhere, and hey, they could have slid over into the slow lane, the assholes. Pissed, I pulled over and shot the finger at the laughing carload of kids as they blew by me with their radio blaring. I guess maybe I was doing 65, 70, I don't know. So they must have been doing at least 80 miles an hour when they slammed into the side of the freight train, crossing the highway maybe 50, 80 feet ahead. I saw the crash and the explosion and the destruction in kind of a dreamlike slow motion. I had to shake myself awake to slam on the brakes and skid into the median maybe no more than 10 feet away from the wreck. The train was screaming to a stop. Jeannie was screaming, and I guess I was too. There was nothing left of the front of their car. The freight train had carried it for who knows how many yards as the engineer desperately tried to stop that train. The engine block was still steaming in the frame where the rear of the car sat. There was no fire, but the smell of gasoline and, cheap booze was everywhere. I knew I should do something, but I had no clue what that should be. I got out and went over to what was left of the car. I will not describe the carnage except to say that they had hit a freight train going 80 miles an hour. The back seat was a mass of broken glass and broken teenagers, out for the same kind of highway run I'd been on. Now, I'm no doctor, but I didn't have to be one to see that these kids were dead or dying. I'm not sure how many were shattered there on the back seat, but there was one young girl whose eyes and words have haunted my very soul for 50 years now. I was a wannabe hippie in those days. My hair was down to my shoulders, and I had this scraggly, half-assed beard thing going on, and I was prone to wearing white cotton or muslin shirts. I could hear the sirens in the distance and knew the first responders were on the way, and I guess I knew I wasn't supposed to move anyone. Not that I had the balls to do anything like that anyway. The girl looked up from the floor and reached for me. I put my shaking hand through the window, and I held her hand. "Jesus, I knew you'd be here. Don't leave me, Jesus. Jesus, don't let me die." "Jesus? Me?" "Christ, kid, you couldn't be any more wrong." "I see you, Jesus. Stay with me." About that time, the scene filled up with METs and fire personnel and cops and a lot of other people. An officer moved Jeannie and me back to the car. He asked us a ton of questions and asked what we saw and took down our statements. And then he asked if we'd be willing to go to court if we had to. Sure, man. Just let me get out of here, okay? It actually took a long time before we were allowed to leave. We sat for a lot of hours on that humid night, watching ambulances, the wreckers, the cops, and what amounts to the business of death on the highway. When the train finally pulled off and we were back on the road, we didn't speak for a long time. And then I looked over at her and I said, "I didn't even see that train. I didn't see it at all. Borrowed time." So I'm sorry if that one is a little tough, but you know, they come up the way they come up, as we've talked many times before on radio. I don't plan these things. I just kind of roll with what's on the top of my head, write down a few notes before I sit down here and start talking to you. And that story's been around a while, and I just kind of felt like, all right, I'm going to tell it. And so there it is. There it is, and I hope it's okay. I hope it's okay. I know it's a tough one. But something came up in that one that that occurred to me today that's a little bit different. I've been watching, I mentioned in that one that I'm a wannabe old hippie. I never quite made it to the full hippie category, living in outside of Baltimore, Maryland, in my little suburb. At the time, you know, I would buy the paisley shirts and had the blue jeans with the peach symbol on the butt. But I have to tell you about that sidetrack here. My dad, may he rest, was a rather strict guy when it came to my attire. He was not crazy about the whole hippie thing at all. And one of his famous phrases when it came to my hair, for example, was, "Go get a haircut, and I want to see some eyeballs and some ears." Because he didn't like the whole long hair thing. And with clothes, he could be really strict, really strict. But I, of course, you know, I wanted to dress like the kids that were around me. But my dad and my mom, to a certain degree, but my dad especially, they were very particular about how I looked when I went to school. So for a long time, I wore slacks, you know, men's Sansa belt kind of slacks looking thing and a white shirt. And early on, until I literally had to threaten to run away from home, I wore a bow tie. There are a lot of school pictures out there of me with the other kids wearing polo shirts and, you know, nice shirts and stuff. And I'm sitting there with my little white shirt and my bow tie. But I finally got him off the bow tie, but getting him away to where I could wear blue jeans and a t-shirt and something like that to school, that was just not going to happen. So I literally would have my kind of pseudo hippie clothes, my red, white, and blue tennis shoes, and my blue jeans with a peace symbol on the butt, and whatever else, you know, whatever shirt was cool at the moment, my Paisley, maybe my Paisley Nehru shirt. Yes, you know, maybe my parents were right about not letting me wear that stuff. But anyway, I would hide it in the woods in a bag between my house and the bus stop that I took to school. I would go out in the morning, dress the way my parents expected me to dress, stop and grab the bag, and then I'd either change at my friend Dwayne's house, who lived just on the other side of the woods, or I would literally, if the weather was, you know, conducive to this sort of nonsense, I would literally change my clothes in the woods, put the other clothes in the bag, go to school, come home, get off the bus, change my clothes again, and go back home. And hoping, thinking, believing my parents were none the wiser. Now, as I got older and years moved on and I grew up and moved away from home and stuff, I found out that, you know, basically, especially my mom, she knew all along, but, you know, it was my dodge. And I was pretty good about buying my own clothes. We didn't have a ton of money. So if I wanted the cool clothes at the time, I had to come up with a way to buy them on my own, work a little bit after school, cut some lawns, whatever, shovel snow. You know, otherwise, I don't know about you guys, but we got school clothes and we had play clothes. School clothes and play clothes. You were not supposed to play outside in your school clothes. If you ripped the knee of your school pants, first of all, there would be hell to pay. And secondly, you would be wearing those school pants with the knee torn out, with maybe your mom having sewn up the knee or trying to patch the knee. Now, my mom was good at a lot of things. My mom could make a quilt that you could sell. She could crochet stuff that was just amazing. It looked like stuff in the stores. But when it came to sewing clothes, she had no time for that sort of thing. So if you had on a pair of, I don't know, khaki-looking beige pants, and you ripped the knee out, she would certainly sew them up, sew that knee up. And I can guarantee you, either by design or by accident or by, I'm just going to get this done and don't care, there's four kids to feed, and she would sew that knee up with red thread. There would be red thread on your knee until it came around to maybe Christmas or January, when you could get some more school clothes and, you know, you got a new pair of pants. Otherwise, it was the red thread. And, you know, come on, you've been to school. Kids see those sort of things. They know that these things, and they're like, oh, you got your pants on today that your mom sewed for you. You know, anyway, I was a pseudo wannabe hippie, you know, 69, 70, 71, 72, 73. And I've been watching this documentary about the music from Laurel Canyon, about the music that came out then. And Mamas and Papas and the Birds and, you know, those bands, Buffalo Springfield and all of those bands that I just still, it's my favorite music, you know, moving on into Jackson Browne and Eagles and all of that stuff. And watching that, seeing the ethos there with Joni Mitchell and Crosby, Stills and Nash, and seeing that this was a very special place and a special time. And it kind of expands out and takes a look at how everybody had this sense of connection then. Everybody kind of felt this this wave of people, you know, 21-ish, 22-ish, 24-ish people. I mean, this is right around 69, you know, this is right around Woodstock when 500,000 people showed up. And how we really felt that we were doing something different. We had this sense that we were a community and we were going to make changes and we were going to do things differently and we were going to see things differently and we're going to remake the world, you know, based on this music and this art, because we really believe that the music and the art could change things, could make things different and make things better and communicate this message of, you know, kindness and living in Laurel Canyon and living in these little communities where everybody kind of knew each other and nobody locked doors and nobody, you know, felt whatever when someone came knocking on your door, maybe didn't even knock on the door. Maybe they walked in the house and they were had a guitar with them and you were playing guitar and it was just a different vibe. And yeah, I mean, you know, of course there was weed around and there was other drugs around, and that can be looked at as a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not going to pass any judgment on that. It was never my thing, but pretty much everyone around me had a different opinion about it. And I don't know what they saw or what they found or what they heard in it, but boy, some of that music and some of that art, well, no, it's still the stuff that moves me the most, that it will catch my ear the most, that chimes in my ear the most. And no, for a large part, I guess we didn't really change the world. We didn't change everything, but some things got done. Some things got done. I think a greater respect started to develop for women who started out in the beginning of that 60s, 65, 60, you know, they were just still kind of like secondary citizens or maybe even groupies or whatever. And things changed and they became more equal and more equal and more equal. And you've got Joni Mitchell and Grace Slick and Janis Joplin and people like that. And their powers. And then, of course, all of the work on all sides for equality and race and equality and a lot of things. And it goes back and forth and it ebbs and it flows. But I would submit that period of time was sort of an awakening, sort of an enlightenment. And I know I became more aware of, for example, I became more aware of the Black kids that went to school with me. I mean, we were sort of on the tail end of people having to be, not bussed in so much, but they had never been into a white school before. And so we had in our little white high school there in Maryland, 10, 15, 20 Black kids all of a sudden were going to school with us in, 69, 68, 69, 70, they were there. And it was kind of like, you know, that feeling of, well, you know, there they are and they're sitting at their own lunch table. They're not really sitting with us and we're not really sitting with them. And how do we cross that divide? How do we make that distance not so big? How do we find out who they are? I mean, they live on a road that goes into our neighborhood, for crying out loud. They live right there and we drive through their neighborhood, because you have to remember, I mean, there were Black neighborhoods then, you know, right in the middle of our little suburban farm, rural kind of place. There was a neighborhood that was a predominantly Black neighborhood. That's where the Black kids lived, and that's where they had their basketball courts, and that's where they played in the street. And so we drove through their neighborhoods, but we never interacted. So how do you cross that divide after all this time? Well, for me, and I think for a lot of people, it was art. It was music, you know? All of a sudden, you've got a band, you've got a local band playing at the dance, and one of the Black kids is in the band. One of the Black kids is singing in the band. And then some of the kids would come out and see a really good band from my day, back in the day, called Blue Mountainside. And they did a lot of R&B influenced kind of stuff. And the kids would come out and see it. And they, you know, then we did plays with folks. There was a kid named Alan, whose last name I can't remember. He did plays with us, and he was just a great actor and a great comic. And then there was David Green. I mean, David Green was the best actor in my high school by a large mile. I have no idea whatever happened to him, but this guy was so talented and so handsome and just so much someone to admire. And really, you know, it was kind of like this, I don't know how to describe it. It was like this feeling that, oh man, you know, I have a whole new set of influences and people to be around and people to talk to. And, it was just eye-opening. And it just happened then, 69, 70, 71, 72, 73. By the time I got out of school in 73, there was no black lunch table or white lunch table. I mean, there were still jocks and freaks. And, you know, I was lucky in that environment too, because I could play a little bit of baseball. I was a pretty good baseball player. And I also could play guitar. So even though I was kind of a freak with my long hair and my red, white, and blue flag tennis shoes and my t-shirts and stuff, the jocks kind of accepted me because we played music together. I mean, one of the guys that played drums in my band was a football player. On, you know, when he wasn't being a drummer, he was a football player. So, you know, we had that, you know, there was a little bit of a symbiosis, a little bit of connection there where maybe some of the other more freaky kids, because again, I was a wannabe hippie. I never quite made the whole step because I was a little too cautious, a little too nervous, a little too whatever when it came to the whole scene of, you know, people actually. I knew people that left and went to California and you know, went to Colorado and went to Arizona. I wasn't one of those guys yet. I hadn't quite made that. I mean, I had the ethos in my head. I had all of it in my head that, yeah, you know, I want to go out there and I want to wear what I want to wear and be who I want to be and, you know, speak out against this, you know, provincial little whatever that I was born in and I grew up in. But not quite. Because part of the problem was a lot of kids that were doing that in my neighborhood, their parents were rough. Their parents were tough and were really, you know, old school, you know, really hardcore old school. And so to do that, they had to fight pretty hard. My parents were cool. I mean, they didn't agree with everything I said and didn't agree with everything I did. And they were pretty conservative in a lot of ways. And they had a lot of lessons to learn too. And I had a lot of lessons to learn from them. But on the overall, they were very, very mellow for me to do things. I mean, I remember my dad one time, you know, I would be sitting up in my bedroom practicing my guitar very loudly. And I know Springsteen likes to tell the stories about his dad coming in and saying, "Turn down that goddamn guitar," and, you know, and all that stuff. I didn't get that. I mean, I remember very clearly my parents having a conversation that I overheard where basically my dad said, "Yeah, it's loud and it's annoying and it's not very good, but at least we know where he's at." And they kind of always opened up their home to me and whatever musicians that I was going to bring home. We had band practices down in the basement. And again, I was there during those years, but this was a gentler part of those years. You know, we were mostly not dropping acid or smoking dope or whatever in the basement. We were having pizza, drinking Cokes, and learning how to play rock and roll songs, you know, working our way through a T-Rex tune or something. That was a little different there. That was a little different when I discovered, you know, glam rock and Mark Bolan and T-Rex and David Bowie and all that stuff. That was a bit of stretch, even for my dad and even for my parents, when I started wearing eye makeup and glitter platform shoes and skin tight pink pants or whatever. That was tough because, you know, again, now think about this. We're like talking the 70s here. A lot of guys are going, you know, flannel and, you know, Allman Brothers and all of that stuff. And I'm reading Melody Maker from you know, England and getting involved in this music, this Bowie and this theatrical glam rock with Mark Bolan and T-Rex and some of the other bands. I mean, for some reason, I have no idea why. I could never tell you why. All of a sudden, this music became my thing. Rather than, you know, the music that was all around me, rather than all of the you know, the rock and roll, I decided that I wanted to do this, you know, glam rock thing. So I literally started a band that played that stuff. And I had a great guitar player. His name was Wayne Dawes, myself, my brother Kenny playing drums. Can't remember who played bass. Might have been Dennis Lynn. I don't know. Anyway, we decided that we were going to, I was out of high school by now, maybe a year out or so. I decided that, you know, I was going to teach my high school lesson, you know, and I was going to go back here with this glam rock band when they were having a battle of the bands. They were having, you know, high school battle of the bands. Come on. Some of you guys got to remember this, where like four or five local bands come into the high school gymnasium and they bring their fan club, and each one brings, you know, 10, 15, 20 people, five people, depending on how many fans they had. And we brought no people. We had like zero fans because, you know, I was very, it's kind of my fault that I was very adamant about when the band was practicing, I didn't allow anybody in the basement. So we couldn't, you know, we couldn't have a fan club come down to watch us play. I wouldn't even let the guys bring their girlfriends, because I still contend after all this time that if you let girls come to the basement or whatever, then you stop practicing and you start performing. It's just a different vibe. And I think if you watch, you know, the Beatles doing Get Back, that new TV, you'll see that new film about them. You'll see that sort of happens. All of a sudden there's people around and they're not really focusing on one another. Anyway. So we did the battle of the bands at my old high school. And, I don't know if I have language at my disposal to describe how much people hated us. How much people hated us, and how like we got absolutely no attention at all here in my provincial little town outside of Baltimore, Maryland, where we played, I think, Rebel Rebel by David Bowie and maybe some Mott the Hoople and certainly some Mark Bolan and T-Rex. And we didn't get any applause. We didn't get any applause at all. I mean, the band that played, you know, Smoke on the Water won, I'm sure. Anyway, and that was, you know, but I kept trying to do that kind of music. And what was weird is that concurrently with that, I had my great love, and still do, my great love for acoustic music and country music and bluegrass music and folk music. So I always had a foot in both of those worlds. So I'll tell you more stories coming up about the Last Chance Band, which was my best known band when I was a kid. And I mentioned them a little bit the last time. I'll tell you some more stories coming up about them, because what happened with the Last Chance Band is that we kept the whole thing going country-wise. We turned into a country rock band, you know, again, that Laurel Canyon thing, you know, we turned into a band that did that kind of music. And yet inside of that music, a lot of us still dressed like we were in a glam rock band. My brother back there playing drums in a country music band wearing spandex pants was something. And I would often wear a t-shirt with the collar and the arms cut off. And we're out there, you know, playing in these country bars dressed like that, which offered up an entirely different set of problems. But anyway, so we started off a little sad and a little grim today. And then hopefully it kind of got a little bit more fun, a little bit more interesting for you to listen to. This is radio. I'm Ray Weaver. And please listen, tell your friends about it. Wherever you get it, please leave a review and a rating and let people know you like it. If you can do the 5-star review or whatever that is, if you do that, please do, because it helps people find the show. And of course, I'd like as many people to hear it as I can get. And don't forget, I have a book out called A Father's Heart. It's available on Amazon. The best version in my mind is always going to be the audiobook, because it has stories and music. So go have a look at that. I've got a new book that I'm working on this year. I'll tell you more about that and those stories and that music when it's ready. And I'll be out on the road playing some music. Hope to see you soon. Thanks for listening. I'm Ray Weaver, and this is Radio.